Here we do 3 half-hours of the Buddha. Okay, so testing one, two. This doesn't seem to be very well. Or maybe it's muted. Testing one, two. Testing, 1, 2. Testing, 1, 2.
Test.
Testing, 1, 2, 3. Okay, we begin with homage to the Buddha. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa.
Good morning, everybody. Okay, today we will be taking sutta number 26 in the Majjhima-nikaya. This is called the Arya Pariyesara Sutta, which means the noble search. And this is a story about the Buddha's own quest for enlightenment. And so I will weave together this sutta together with passages from another sutta, number 36, which also deals with the story of the Buddha's quest for enlightenment. And generally, within the oldest discourses, the Nikayas, we don't find an interest in the biography of the Buddha so much for the purpose of recording biographical facts. Is that thing working okay? Okay. Okay, so we don't find an interest in the life of the Buddha from the standpoint of recording biographical facts, but certain stories about the Buddha's quest for enlightenment and his activities are given in a way to set up, you might call this a kind of paradigm or a model for, that serves as an example or model for the followers of the Buddha's path. So we could say that the life of the Buddha serves as a supreme example, the supreme model of a life which is dedicated to enlightenment, to realization. Okay, so the sutta begins one time when the Buddha was living in the town of Savatthi, and then there was a group of monks who apparently they might have come from elsewhere, because they say that they had not heard, for a long time they had not heard a discourse from the Buddha himself. And so they go to the Buddha's attendant, Venerable Ananda, and ask whether they can have that privilege of hearing the Buddha give a discourse. And then Ananda indicates to these monks, he says, you should go to the hermitage of a Brahmin named Ramaka. And then he says, perhaps you will get to hear a discourse from the Blessed One's own lips. In other words, Ananda is giving them a kind of hint that he is going to take the steps in requesting the Buddha to give a discourse for the sake of those monks. Okay, so then in the evening, for the afternoon, the Buddha and Ananda, they go to another place in Savatthi called the Eastern Park. They spend the day there. And then in the evening, when they get up from their meditation, they go to a place, to the bathing place. Then after their bath, the Venerable Ananda says to the Buddha, in fact he says, let's go to the hermitage of the Brahmin Ramaka. And he praises this place in a way to try to persuade the Buddha to go there. The Buddha agrees by silence, and then they go to the hermitage of this Brahmin. And now when they arrive, then these monks are sitting in the hermitage. They've already gone there, and so they're discussing the Dhamma. Then the Buddha enters, and then he asks, what is the discussion that you were engaged in just now? And then the monks say that our discussion was about the Buddha himself. Okay, then the Buddha says, good monks, then he makes an important statement. He says, it is fitting for you, young men who have gone forth out of faith from the home life into homelessness, to sit together to discuss the Dharma. When you gather together, you should do either of two things. You should hold discussion on the Dhamma, or maintain noble silence.
Zhang Chen发誓现在在哪里你们要告诉他今天上课你睡怎么样我们睡我们要一起来要 两个东西要做一个动一个我们要说法还是或者要默认对不对我想他说话太多
Okay, so when you sit together, you should do either of two things. Either hold discussion on the Dhamma, or else maintain noble silence. very important instructions, because in monastic circles these days there's a tendency not to pay much attention to that. Okay, so now the Buddha is going to come into the main part of the discourse. He speaks about two kinds of searches, or we could say two kinds of quests. Here, the Pali word that's used is the word that comes, it's the title of the sutta. The word is pariyesana, which means seeking, seeking, questing. And so the two kinds of search are called the noble search and the ignoble search. And so the noble search is arya pariyesana, and the ignoble search is anarya pariyesana. Okay, so these are like the Buddha's here setting up like two aims, two aspirations for people. So first he takes the ignoble search. What is the ignoble search? Okay, someone who is himself subject to birth seeks what is subject to birth, being himself subject to aging, seeks what is also subject to aging, being subject to sickness, to death, to sorrow, to defilement. He seeks what is also subject to defilement. Okay, so here I think six things are set up. You say six imperfections, being subject to birth, aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement or corruption. And so the ignoble quest is to have one's whole life center around acquiring more and more of these things that are marked by these six characteristics. And so then the Buddha raises the question, what is it that is subject to birth, aging, sickness, death, and so on? Okay, then he mentions in terms of the types of objects that were sought after in this particular period of Indian history. We can make appropriate substitutions to apply it to today. Okay, so what is subject to birth and so on? Okay, sorry, this is not so fashionable, but wife and children are subject to birth. Okay, for women you could say husband and children subject to birth. Men and women slaves. Okay, in India at that time was a slave-holding society. Goats and sheep, fowl and pigs, elephants, cattle, horses and mares, gold and silver are subject to birth. Okay, what would we say today? People don't go around, unless they're farmers, collecting goats and sheep, fowl and pigs, elephants, cattle, horses and mares, automobiles.
iPods.
Excuse me?
iPod,
yeah. Somebody gave me an iPod about 2 weeks ago. I looked at it and thought, too complicated. iPod, what else?
Stocks, bonds, securities.
Yeah, exactly. Stocks.
The Cayman Islands, yeah, that's what you want.
Stocks, bonds, securities? Accounts in Switzerland?
Yeah.
Cayman, what are the Cayman Islands?
Caymans are better.
Cayman.
You can't see them. They're like secret accounts.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
How do you get one?
Very wealthy.
You have to be very wealthy.
State legislatures.
Okay, so stocks, bonds, assets, credit defaults. Is that mortgages? Yeah. Okay, so there are many things that people want. Boats now, private, their own little boats, yachts.
Plastic surgery, Botox.
Yeah.
Plastic surgery, you know, Botox, that
pretty good idea. Yeah, plastic surgery.
100-year-old eggs. 100-year-old eggs.
100-year-old eggs.
Is it, don't
Oh, really? Yeah. Never heard of it before. Fine wines and liqueurs, yeah. Caviar. Okay, then he uses very important words for understanding the early texts. These acquisitions are subject to birth. The word in Pali, it's very difficult to translate adequately into English. Yeah, this word is upadi, which it's based on the root da, which means to place, and the prefix upa sometimes has the sense of near. So upadi would be literally things that are placed near oneself. And so it comes to take on the meaning of things that one acquires, things one possesses. One might even translate, in fact, more recently I've been translating the word as assets, things that one takes upon oneself and acquires possession over. And then this word comes to be used in different ways in different contexts, so that the word upadi can mean, on the one hand, it can mean material possessions. It can also mean the things that constitute our own being, which are the five aggregates. The five aggregates are called upadi, because those are the things that one takes upon oneself, one's most intimate possessions. And then the word upadi also comes to mean the act of taking possession. So you can see it's the act of acquisition. So it has this sort of double meaning. On the one hand, it's the things that one takes possession of, the objects of acquisition, the objects of attachment. And also, it is the act of acquisition, the act of claiming possession. And then we find in the text, there's a word based on upadi, it's the negation of it, nirupadi, which I wrote on the board. And this means without acquisitions, or free from acquisitions. And this word is used as a synonym for nibbana, nirvana. So nibbana is nirupadi, because one who has attained nibbana doesn't take possession of anything, doesn't claim possession over anything. And we can say inwardly this person has cast off all acquisitions, the act of acquiring things. Okay, so these are the acquisitions that the Buddha is speaking of, And then the Buddha says, one who is tied to these things, we could say addicted to these things, infatuated with them, then here I would maybe change this to, and addicted to them, being himself subject to birth, seeks what is also subject to birth. Okay, so we have all of these possessions, prize, possessions, assets, things that one acquires. When one becomes attached to these things, and one can't live without them, and one continuously is seeking them, that is what binds one to continued birth. And so one is subject to birth, one seeks what is subject to birth, and because of that, one undergoes birth again and again. And the same thing is repeated in regard to what is subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow, except some things are excluded from sorrow. Gold and silver is excluded from sorrow, plus the money doesn't weep. And then subject to defilement. Okay, so that all is considered the ignoble search. And we have to understand also, in the Buddha's time, society, culture had been undergoing very rapid and drastic changes. It was changing from a very quiet, structured agricultural society into an urban society. Towns were growing and expanding, developing into cities. The people who had been previously low in the social system, the vaishyas, the merchants, the farmers, were now rising up because they were developing their businesses and they were becoming wealthy landowners, wealthy businessmen. And so society was in a state of flux, commotion, change, and this kind of what we call today materialism was spreading out through the whole culture, just almost the way it is today. So we should imagine that ancient Indian culture was always a very deeply religious and spiritual culture, but there was a kind of growing materialism that was spreading and changing the whole face of society. And the Buddha would have observed this. Probably it was one of the spurs that induced him to leave the worldly life and become a spiritual seeker. Okay, so that is the ignoble search. And now the Buddha is going to contrast that with the noble search. Here I come to paragraph 12. So what is the noble search? Here, someone being himself subject to birth, having understood the danger or the drawback, the defect in what is subject to birth, seeks the unborn supreme security from bondage, nibbana. Okay, here we have another important term in this sentence. The word is what, it's the Pali word that's translated danger. This is the word adinava. Okay, this word adinava, you say, has the sense of the defect, the deficiency, the shortcomings, the drawbacks, the wretchedness, the misery, the disadvantage. All of these are just implications of this word, adhinava. And so what serves as the spur, the goad, the inducement to enter upon the life of spiritual seeking, the life of renunciation, the quest for liberation, is understanding the danger and defects in things that are subject to birth, old age, sickness, death, sorrow, and corruption or defilement. And so when one understands this, then he seeks not the things that are subject to decay, but he turns his mind to seek that which is not subject to birth, and that's called Anuttara Yoga Kema, which means the supreme or unsurpassed security from bondage. Yeah, the word yoga here, it's the same word that eventually came to be applied to these physical exercises that we now call yoga. But the original sense of the word yoga was, on the one hand, it meant exertion, effort. And the Buddha actually praises yoga in this sense. He always says, yogo karaniyo, that an exertion should be made. One should strive vigorously. But the word yoga, it's also like the English word yoke. The word yoke means something which confines one or binds one. And so yoga, in this sense, is a bond. And then the goal is yoga kema, to be free from the bonds, to be released from the bonds. And so that is what is called yoga kema, the security from bondage. And then even when one releases the cattle from their yokes, probably that's the original sense of yoga kema. The cattle, the farmer is using the ox, to plow the fields, so he puts a yoke over them. Then when he removes the yoke, the oxen reach a state called yoga kema. They're released from the yoke, released from the bond. But the Buddha speaks about anuttara yoga kema, the supreme security from bondage. And that is nirvana, which is said to be unborn, unproduced, unarisen. And similarly, one who is subject to aging understands the danger in what is subject to aging. So he seeks, again, nibbana, which is free from aging. Again, it's free from sickness. It's the deathless. It's the sorrowless. And it is the undefiled. The undefiled supreme security from bondage. So that is called the noble search. Okay, at this point I'll ask whether there's any questions based on what I've covered so far. Okay, I see you, Matt.
The only question I have is why Ananda didn't directly ask Buddha to come to the hall where the other bhikkhus were abiding, waiting for him? Sort of brought there by subterfuge in a way?
Yeah, I don't know, actually. I don't know. I don't know the reason. Any other questions? Okay, okay, please, yeah.
Sorry, I just had a thought. Maybe that was Ananda's way, because you know sometimes Ananda could make the Buddha do things Buddha didn't want to do, usually out of kindness for other people.
Yeah.
He was very respectful of the Buddha, but he could also, in his own way, kind of be like, what about this? What about this? What about this? So
yeah.
You get that sense of
maybe sort of, maybe sort of it doesn't seem that Ananda is giving orders to the Buddha.
I mean, sometimes he's direct, but sometimes he just, if he wants something done, but he gets it. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Later in the sutta, there is a section where the Buddha says, I'm giving up, I'm being passive, I'm not doing anything direct, and maybe this is a parallel to that, where the Buddha's been so passive, allowing this to happen rather than.
We'll see, I'm not so sure. Okay, anyway, let us go on. There's a question from the internet, but it's about rather technical about usage of Pali words, so I don't want to go into it now. Okay, so now the Buddha has set up this contrast between the two kinds of quests, the ignoble quest and the noble quest. And now the Buddha is going to relate this to his own life story, which is interesting here because you see the Buddha is setting up first the contrast between these two types of, well, these two types of orientation in life. And then the Buddha is going to show that he understands this from his own experience, that it's not something like he is a pious preacher sitting up on the platform giving a lecture that on something he hasn't experienced himself, but he's going to show how he has learned this through his own hard life experience. Okay, so the Buddha says, before my enlightenment, while I was still only a bodhisattva, not yet enlightened, I too, being myself subject to birth, sought what is also subject to birth. And so with what is subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow, defilement, and so on. So the Buddha, maybe the story about him being an actual prince, it's legendary because the Sakyan state was not a kingdom, but it was a republic. But the Buddha was from one of the aristocratic clans. He would have had all of the privileges of the aristocracy. According to other suttas, his father had built for him three palaces, one for each season of the Indian year. He would live in the palace surrounded by dancing girls, musicians. He would have lotus gardens. Certainly he would be eating every day the most delicious food. No worries, no cares, no troubles. Then when he was 16 years old, he was married. And probably as a young man, he was still not satisfied with all of this, but he would always have been seeking more because that was the temperament of the Kshatriyas, the warrior class in India. But at some point, the Bodhisattva began to question himself and to ask, why, being myself subject to birth, do I also seek what is subject to birth, and so on. Then he says, suppose that I go out, now that I've seen the danger in what is subject to birth, let me go out to seek the unborn supreme security from bondage, Nibbana. Okay, so this is the way the Buddha is reflecting. You know, in the legendary life of the Buddha, we have this told in the form of, well, a legend that the Bodhisattva had never even, didn't even know that there was such a thing as old age, sickness and death. But one day, out of curiosity, he wanted to see what was life was like outside the palace. And so he asked his father, please let me travel outside the palace. His father cleared up the whole city, he gave orders, get rid of all of the old people, no sick people, no funerals this day. And so when the Bodhisattva went out, there were all young, beautiful, happy people applauding him and cheering him. But then suddenly, out of nowhere, there appeared an old man walking on a stick, then a sick man lying on the side of the road, trembling and weeping, and then a funeral took place with a corpse being carried to the cremation ground. So that is, we call this the legend, it's a kind of external representation of what is really going on in the Bodhisattva's mind, which is reflecting deeply on the real facts of life, reflecting on birth, old age, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement. Okay, so then he says, a little sometime later, while still a young man in the prime of life, though my mother and father wished otherwise and wept with tearful faces, I shaved off my hair and beard, put on the kshaya, it's not really yellow, it's a kind of brownish orange robe, and I went forth from the home life into homelessness. Okay, during the Buddha's time, and probably going back even several hundred years earlier, it was the custom for those who wanted to realize truth, to achieve liberation from the cycle of birth and death, to leave the household life and take on the lifestyle of what is called a samana. The samana is an ascetic, a monastic person, a renunciant. And so when the Bodhisattva was a prince thinking about leaving the household life or thinking about the problems of birth, old age, sickness and death, he had a certain precedent or a model to follow, and that is to adopt the lifestyle of an ascetic. And so in the Buddha's time there were ascetics who had was living in the forest, sometimes alone, sometimes in communities. Some of them would just wear a loincloth. Some would go completely naked. Others would wear white robes. And others would wear, probably most of them would wear, a kind of copper-colored saffron ochre robe. And so the Bodhisattva, following their example, shaved off his hair, beard, and then put on the yellow robe, the saffron robe, and entered the homeless life. And when one entered the homeless life, the usual path that one followed was to seek out a teacher. One would be looking for somebody who knows the way to wisdom, somebody who knows the way to enlightenment. So probably after the Bodhisattva left the palace and became a wanderer, he would meet with fellow wanderers and ask, who are the wise teachers around? Like, who are the top-rated gurus of the day? And so people would make some recommendations to him, and one of the people that was he must have heard high praise of in different circles was a man named Alara Kalama. Okay, so now the Bodhisattva comes to Alara Kalama and he says, I want to lead the holy life in this Dhamma and discipline. And it's interesting that the text uses this double expression here. In Pali, the word is Dhamma Vinaya. And this is the word that the Buddha applies most often to his own teaching. So what the Buddha himself teaches is a Dhamma, which is the doctrine, and then the word Vinaya has come to take on the meaning of the code of monastic rules. But actually, probably the older, more original sense of Vinaya is the course of training, the course of practice. And so every teacher also during this period would have had his own Dhamma Vinaya. The Dhamma would have been some kind of philosophical doctrine which laid out kind of intellectual or conceptual structure around which the quest for enlightenment was arranged or organized. And then at the heart of his teaching, there would have been a course of training, which is not just observing rules and regulations, but it's a way of training every aspect of one's life, one's behavior, but also especially a way to train the mind through the practice of a meditative discipline. We don't know exactly what kind of doctrine and discipline Alara Kalama taught, but all we know is that he set up a certain meditative attainment as being the peak or high point of his system. Okay, so the Bodhisattva comes to Alara and says that he wants to lead the spiritual life, the holy life, in this Dhamma and Vinaya. Then Alara praises his own doctrine. He says, this doctrine is such that a wise person can soon enter and dwell in it, realizing for himself through direct knowledge his own teacher's doctrine. In other words, here Alara, I think this is an important point when we consider the later development of Indian spirituality, in which there's a lot of emphasis upon submitting to the guru, surrendering to the guru, venerating the guru. At this time, from this we could see that Alara, just like the Buddha, is pointing out that the important thing is not himself as the person, but what's important is the teaching or his Dhamma. And he's also saying that I'm not the only one who has realized this, but any wise person who practices diligently can realize this same goal for himself. Okay, so the Bodhisattva says that he quickly learned this Dhamma, and then as far as recitation went, he was able to speak with knowledge and assurance about it, and to say, I know this, I understand this. So himself, and there were others too. And so it seems at first the Bodhisattva mastered the theory about Alara's teaching. But he wasn't satisfied with this. And so he thinks it's not through mere faith alone that Alara speaks about his doctrine, but he speaks on the basis of knowledge and insight. And so then the Bodhisattva comes to Alara and says, how do you speak, on what basis do you speak about entering and realizing this doctrine? And when the Bodhisattva asks this, Alara then explains to him what is called the base of nothingness. Okay, now the base, what is this base of nothingness? In the Buddha's own system of meditation, there are eight stages of samadhi, eight stages of deep concentration. The first four are the four jhanas. These are called simply the first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. So those are stages in which the mind is becoming more and more collected, concentrated, focused, and absorbed into a state of deep peace and tranquility. But beyond the four jhanas, there are four other stages of samadhi, which are called the formless meditations. In Pali, these are called the arupa attainments. These are called arupa samapatti. That means the meditative attainments without any form as its object. The jhanas have some kind of visible form as their object, like a bright, beautiful, radiant light. But in the formless attainments, even that beautiful, bright light vanishes, and there's an absorption of the mind without any kind of visible form for the mind to latch onto. And so the four formless attainments, the lowest is called the base of infinite space. So all form drops away, and there's just left a kind of mental perception of the infinity of space. Then going beyond that comes the second level, which is called the base of infinite consciousness. So space drops away, the awareness of space drops away, and the mind focuses upon the infinite expanse of consciousness itself. In the third stage, even consciousness as an object drops away, and there remains what is called nothingness. It's a kind of state without any obstruction, any impediment, any kind of substantial object ahead of it, in front of it. Okay, so Alara Kalama was able to enter into that state called the base of nothingness. And apparently, he took the attainment of that state to be the attainment of liberation, the attainment of enlightenment. Okay, so the Bodhisattva reflected that he has all the qualities needed to realize that attainment. He has faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. And so he makes a determined effort to reach that meditative state. And so he quickly enters and dwells in that state, experiencing it for himself. He goes to his teacher, Alara, and reports what he has achieved. And then Alara doesn't get envious and resentful, but he congratulates the young Bodhisattva. Maybe Alara is an older man, maybe 55, 60 years old. Now that seems young to me. And the Bodhisattva is just 29 years old, maybe 30 years old. And yet the old master is overjoyed that his new disciple has realized this state. And so he says, it's a gain for us, a great gain, that we have you for such a companion in the holy life. The Dhamma that I say I enter upon and dwell in, that is the same Dhamma that you enter and dwell in. You know the Dhamma that I know the Dhamma that you know. You are just like myself, I am like you. And now, I'm at the bottom of page 257, he gives a very great honor to the Bodhisattva. He says, come friend, let us now lead this community together. This means that he's making the Bodhisattva his co-teacher. So he's saying, now we're at an equal level as far as attainment realization goes. So I won't be the exclusive teacher anymore, but we will be co-teachers of this group. Probably this was a tempting offer. It's like somebody in the business world says, okay, I'm the president of the company, and now I have some very capable young executive comes in to work for me. He shows himself to be very skilled, very capable, very diligent. And so after just even maybe a few months in the company, he proves himself to be so capable that I think he's just as good as I am. So instead of me being the president and he just being a subordinate, I say, come on, we will be co-presidents of the company. But probably you won't get that in the business world, because then they have to share the salary. Okay, so the Bodhisattva goes on, he says, now he's speaking to the monks, he says, thus Alara Kalama, my teacher, placed me, his pupil, on an equal footing with himself and awarded me the highest honor. But now the Bodhisattva, maybe he said to Alara, let me think about it for a while, you know, not just accepting it once. But when he went off to reflect, then he thought to himself, this Dharma does not lead to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to Nibbana, but only to reappearance in the base of nothingness. Now the word that's translated here, reappearance, actually a better translation would have been rebirth. It leads only to rebirth in the base of nothingness. Okay, what is meant here? According to the Buddha's teaching, our different states of consciousness, different states of mind, are seeds with the potential to lead to rebirth in different realms of existence. So any kind of ethically determinate state of mind is the seed of a rebirth in another realm of existence. Or in some, let's say, the seed of a rebirth in some realm of existence. So if I do the types of deeds typical of a hell realm, for example, killing, harming, injuring other beings, slandering good and worthy people, going around all the time with a mind of hatred and resentment, that state of mind will be function as the seed for a possible rebirth in a hell realm. If I have a mind, mental states, which are generally a mixture of good and bad, say a predominance of good, wholesome states, but with some bad, unwholesome states, that kind of mind is likely to be the seed for a rebirth back into the human realm. If I have a very pure, very good and worthy state of mind most of the time, very generous, very loving, thoughtful, kind, compassionate, that kind of mind is the seed for a rebirth into one of the lower heavenly realms. Now, if I refine that good mind through the practice of meditation to the point that I'm able to gain a state of samadhi, the different levels of samadhi are the seeds for rebirth in the higher heavenly realms. And so there are states that correspond, states of rebirth that correspond to the four jhanas. For example, if I master the third jhana, then when I pass away, my mind will tend to take rebirth in the level, that heavenly world that corresponds to the third jhana. If I master the fourth jhana, I'll tend to take rebirth in that heavenly realm corresponding to the fourth jhana. If I master the base of infinite space, there is a realm corresponding to that state. If I master the base of infinite consciousness, there is a realm corresponding to that state. If I master the meditation of the base of nothingness, then my mind will tend to take rebirth in the realm of nothingness. That's a realm, very, very subtle realm, that corresponds to the meditative state of the base of nothingness. And it's said that in these realms, the mind is very peaceful, very calm, in a state of almost undisturbed equanimity for thousands and thousands of kalpas. Do you know what a kalpa is? A kalpa is a cosmic aeon. So if we take the example of what's called the Big Bang. Now that's the time from this particular world system begins just as a point of very intense light, which just suddenly it explodes, and then space comes into being, and very quickly the universe, starting as a point of light, starts to expand till matter starts to form, the material particles cluster to form atoms, the atoms draw together to form the first stars, the stars draw together to form the first galaxies, the first generation stars explode, then the debris of those exploding stars form the second generation of stars, and the dust matter left by the first generation stars coalesces to form planets. Then we get the world system expanding. Now it's said to be something like 14, 15 billion years. Maybe it goes another 15 billion years. So 30 billion years of expansion. Then the expansion slows down, followed by a period of contraction, maybe another 30 billion years. So altogether 60 billion years. That's one kalpa. Now, the lifespan in the base of nothingness is said to be 60,000 kalpas. That means 60,000 big bangs, expansion of the cosmos, contraction of the cosmos, expansion, contraction. Do that 60,000 times, and that is the lifespan in that realm. And so the meditation masters of that time would have, some of them would have been able to enter into that meditative state, and they would have experienced it as so peaceful, so tranquil, completely undisturbed, and they would have had some sense that if I get my consciousness, when this body falls away, my consciousness will go to that realm and remain there forever. That's what they thought. So that is eternity. That is liberation. That's the perfect, the state of complete perfect spiritual perfection. And that's what they thought. But somehow the Bodhisattva, the future Buddha, probably through his very deep and sharp wisdom, would have understood that this state is not the real liberation, that this is not an eternal state. But after mastering that attainment, one gets reborn there, one dwells there for such an inconceivably long period of time, and then it's a little bit like this thing. Bong! After 60,000 aeons. Bong! Very soft and gentle. Bong! Bong! Can I emerge my samadhi? What is that? Then, so no body, no substance, but a little guy taps me on the shoulder and says, "Time's up, my friend." And I say, "What do you mean, time's up?" He says, "You'll see." And then, zoop! I'm down in the mommy's womb. 9 months later, ow, ow, ow. Rubbing my eyes. What's going on here? Doctor slaps the behind. Then I start wailing. Milk, milk, milk. Then 5 years old, mommy says, "You're starting kindergarten, finished kindergarten, elementary school, junior high school, college applications, what graduate school should I go to? Have to get a job, falling in love, getting married, having children." All over again. All over again. What is that? Bunch of
Suras.
Suras.
You should know.
Loibes Meir. I don't think I've heard that expression since.
You know it, though.
Yeah, I know it. Yeah. Suras, I don't remember.
Pain in the tuchus.
Okay, so that's the way it is, you know, if you get into the base of nothingness. Okay, so the Buddha would have maybe been reflecting on, oh my God, I have to apply to college again? In grad school? I don't want that anymore. So he thought, enough with this Dhamma. Okay, so then he was dissatisfied with that, disappointed. He leaves. Okay, so then still searching. Again, he's probably meeting wanderers, wandering ascetics on the roads, asking, who is the accomplished one? Then they point him to somebody named Uttaka Ramaputta. Uttaka would have been his proper name. Ramaputta means the son of Rama. Now this is important, because the Bodhisattva says, I want to lead again the holy life in this Dhamma and discipline. Uttaka Ramaputta says, you may stay here. Again, he praises the teaching. The Bodhisattva learns it. And then now the Bodhisattva reflects. He says, it was not through mere faith alone that Rama declared, by realizing this for myself with direct knowledge, I enter and dwell in this Dhamma. Now you see, Uttaka Ramaputta himself had not himself mastered that higher meditative state. Uttaka is the son of Rama, and he must have taken his own father as his spiritual teacher. Apparently, Rama himself is dead at this time. And so they remember Rama as somebody who has reached the highest meditative state. But even his son has not yet reached it. But his son was probably the most advanced meditator in the group, and maybe it's a kind of transmission from father to son. And so Uttaka is the head of the group, but all he could do is explain what his father had achieved. Okay, so the Bodhisattva goes to Uttaka and says, what did Rama declare? How did he realize it? And then Uttaka, the son, explains the meditative state, which is called the base of neither perception nor non-perception. So this is the fourth formless meditation. I said there were four formless meditations. The third is the base of nothingness, which the other teacher realized, Alara Kalama. But Rama had achieved the fourth formless attainment, the base of neither perception nor non-perception. It's a state which is said to be so subtle that one can't declare definitely there is perception here, but at the same time one can't say there's no perception here. It's the most refined possible state of mundane consciousness. Okay, so as in the previous case, the Bodhisattva reflects that he wants to realize this for himself. He makes the effort. He attains that state. He attains the base of neither perception nor non-perception. Then he goes to Uttaka Ramaputta and he says, was it in this way that Rama declared that he entered upon and dwelt in this Dhamma? Rama, Uttaka says, that is the way, friend. Then Uttaka praises him and says, it's wonderful, it's a great gain for us that we have such a fellow. He says, that is the state that Rama declared, the same state that you declare. And so everything is the same as previously, except now Uttaka Ramaputta says, he says, as Rama was, so are you. As you are, so is Rama. Come, friend, now you lead this community. So this is different from the previous case. Here, Uttaka is not saying we will be the co-presidents of the corporation. But Uttaka is saying, I step down, I will be the vice president of the corporation. You be the president. you're a more skilled businessman than I am. You've gotten, you know, you've caught the trick for working the ropes of a company. I'm still learning the ropes. Okay, so now the Bodhisattva thinks, he says, thus Uddhaka Ramaputta, who had been my companion in the holy life, placed me in the position of a teacher. He's saying, now you are even my teacher. And he gave me the highest honor. But then it occurs to him that this Dhamma does not lead to disenchantment, dispassion, cessation, peace, direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to Nibbana, but it leads only to rebirth in the base of neither perception nor non-perception. That is, above the sphere of nothingness, in which the lifespan is said to be 60,000 kalpas, there is another sphere called the sphere of neither perception nor non-perception, where the lifespan is said to be 80,000 or 84,000 kalpas. And so here, while the lifespan of the people in the base of nothingness comes to an end at 60,000, you get to go on another 20,000, 24,000 big bangs, world expansion, world contraction. And then, for that reason, those who reach that attainment thought, this is nirvana. This is the absolute perfect state of peace. But then, at the end of the 84,000th world cycle, the alarm goes off. Bang, bang. Haven't heard that in a long time. What's going on here? Again, little finger taps you on the non-existent shoulder and says, guess what, my friend? What? Time's up. Then, exactly as the 84,000th aeon comes to an end, drop down out of the sphere of neither perception nor non-perception, and back down into the mommy's womb, and out into the world after 9 months, and again, kindergarten, nursery school, kindergarten, elementary school, junior high, college, graduate school, the business world, the professional world, old age, aging, retirement, getting sick, and death. So the Bodhisattva thinks, that's not for me. And then he goes on searching. So he gets dissatisfied with that Dhamma, and then disappointed, he leaves it. Okay, any questions? Maybe good to take the mobile microphone.
When you first introduced the state of the infinity of space,
yeah,
you talked about he had the mental perception.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering about what the reference for mental is. Is it just cognitive stuff, or is it citta, or?
Of course, it's the citta. The citta is what is aware of the object. The object is said to be the base of the infinity of space.
I have other questions, but I don't necessarily have to take them in mind. Okay,
why don't you just go ahead and ask?
You talk about the sphere of consciousness, or the sphere of these. I'm interested in this idea of sphere. Why is that the image or the metaphor? What's the word in Pali?
Okay, the word that's used for that is translated by some as sphere, some as, here it's translated base. The Pali word is ayatana. Ooh. think the original sort of metaphorical meaning of Ayatana is a piece of land which is spread out and extended. And so the word that's used sometimes in relation to a place where, like, cattle, certain types of cattle are grown, that is like the base for this type of cow. The certain territories were called the Ayatana for horses. Okay, then it comes to be applied to objects of perception and also the sense faculties, which are bases for the arising of consciousness. And then it also comes to be applied to certain realms of rebirth that correspond to these meditative attainments. Oh, I was just speaking.
What happened?
Oh, I see. You're asking that question.
Yes. It just happens. I mean, we don't need a bomb, but how is one aware that time is up or is it just up?
I think it just the time just comes, just goes by. When the lifespan comes to an end there, then the consciousness falls away from that state.
I have a question about the word bodhisattva.
Yeah.
Because bodhi means enlightened.
Yeah.
The Buddha said, when I was here on an enlightened bodhisattva, so it's self-contradictory. And I remember on another occasion you explained bodhisattva has two meanings. One of them is a person seeking enlightenment. So can I conclude that at least in the Nikayas, that term can never be rendered as enlightened being, but only can be interpreted as a seeker at most. So by no means it can refer to being transcending beyond the realm of birth and death.
Okay, that's the end of the question. Yeah. First, let me get to the matter of the derivation of the word bodhisattva. Of course, I mentioned that in a very early class, I think, when I was working through the other book, so some people haven't gotten that point. This has to do with the difference between Pali or other Middle Indo-Aryan languages and Sanskrit. Okay, in Pali and whatever other early Middle Indo-Aryan languages the Buddha would have used, the word would have been bodhisattva, which is bodhi means enlightenment. Then the word sattva, it's a little ambiguous in Pali. It can mean, in Sanskrit, either sattva, which means a being. So this would be a being who is not already enlightened, but a being who is seeking enlightenment, the enlightenment of Buddhahood. So a being who is seeking to become a Buddha. But the word sattva is rendered into Sanskrit as sattva. And that is the course that the word took when texts were transposed from the Middle Indo-Aryan languages into Sanskrit. The translators took bodhisattva to mean bodhisattva. But the Pali or Middle Indo-Aryan word sattva could also be or correspond to Sanskrit sakta, which means one intent upon, one devoted to. And so the original word could have been bodhisattva, which in Pali or some Prakrit would have become bodhisattva, but the original intention was lost, and instead it was transformed into bodhisattva. We can, so far there's no way that we can know for sure. But in either case, in the early Buddhist teachings, there's no idea that a bodhisattva, even if it's bodhisattva, is already enlightened. But he's rather one who is seeking to become enlightened. And then when a bodhisattva becomes enlightened, he becomes enlightened as a Buddha. Does that answer the question?
But you still said the ambiguity there. There's no.
Yeah, it's ambiguous. There's no way to resolve it. And even the Pali commentary gives both derivations. Yes.
Okay, I've got a little bit of a dead end. Does the Bodhisattva become a Buddha or an Arahant? I said that with a dead end today.
There's no devil. A Buddha is also an Arahant. Okay, but a bodhisattva, the way the word is used in the early text, the Nikayas, the bodhisattva is one who, when he becomes enlightened, he becomes a Buddha. But a Buddha is also an Arahant. But a bodhisattva doesn't become an Arahant who is not a Buddha. So in other words, the Buddha uses the word bodhisattva to refer to himself or to other Buddhas prior to their enlightenment, when they were on their quest for enlightenment. Okay, let me take some of the internet questions. Okay, is there any... Some of these questions are very specialized, so... either about words or about the nature of nirvana. I mean, I just want the questions really to be relevant to the topic of the discourse. Are these seven states, disenchantment, dispassion, cessation, peace, direct knowledge, enlightenment, nirvana, each one progressively superior to the one before? I'd say definitely nirvana is put at the end because it's the culmination of the series. We go disenchantment leads to dispassion, maybe dispassion to cessation, cessation to peace. I don't know, there's some ambiguity at certain points. But definitely enlightenment and nirvana are the two highest of the seven. And disenchantment, dispassion are the beginning of the seven. Okay, we'll have to stop the discussion now and then come back after lunch for discussion, questions, answers. a few just giveaways that I have. I'm still trying to give away this catalog to the Omega Center in Upper New York State, Rhinebeck, New York. There is the new catalog for the New York Open Center Spring Summer Programs. Then this is a West Coast Dharma magazine called Inquiring Mind. They asked me to write the column for each issue, so they give me extra copies. So anybody wants a copy, you're welcome to take. Okay, we'll end with the sharing of the merits, and then we'll take a break.
Akasata chabhumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumodipa chiram rakantu sasanam. Akasata chabhumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumodipa chiram rakantu desanam. Akasata chabhumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumodipa chiram rakantu mam param. Eta vitacha mehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe devanamo tu sabbe bhutanamo dantu sabbe satanamo dantu sabba sampati stidhya pavagupadaya vichetato etantare satakai upapanna rupi arupi cha sanya sanino dukkha pamochantu pusantu niputin.
Okay, thank you for your attention. And I should mention that next week there is a class here. We try to finish the sutta next week. The 22nd, there won't be a class. The 29th, there'll be a class. Free from bondage. Okay, we end with three half bows.
Yes.